After 108 years, the curse has been broken for the Chicago Cubs.
And the Chicago Cubs win the World Series!
I have rooted for my Cubs all my life. From the time I was a kindergartner, this is beyond my dreams.
I cannot believe we are here! Oh my God, we're here!
We broke the streak! We won the World Series! We love the Cubbies!
Those are some of the fans celebrating at Esquire in Champaign last night. We'll hear more from them and check in with sports reporters from ESPN and WBEZ. And for all you Cub fans out there, want to share your euphoria, give us a call at 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-9455, or tweet to 21st Show.
Go, go, go! Go, go, go!
A little bouncer slowly toward Bryant. He will glove it and throw to Rizzo.
It's in time, and the Chicago Cubs win the World Series. The Cubs come pouring out of the dugout, jumping up and down like a bunch of delirious 10-year-olds. The Cubs have done it. The longest drought in the history of American sports is over.
Can you believe it? The Chicago Cubs are World Series champions for the first time in 108 years. As you just heard, it's the longest streak, not just in baseball, but for all of American sport history. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. What a day. That was Cubs broadcaster Pat Hughes with the final call. Cubs fans have been waiting lifetimes for and will be playing again and again for a long time to come.
I have rooted for my Cubs all my life. From the time I was a kindergartner, this is beyond my dreams.
I cannot believe we are here. Oh my God, we're here.
I flew in from San Francisco to Washington, Illinois. Been watching all my life. I'm going to go home and cry.
So exciting. I can't believe they pulled it out.
They did it. I can't believe it.
Oh. We broke the streak. We won the World Series. We love the Cubbies. Harry Carey. You'll be proud. You're looking upon us in heaven, and you will love this moment. I know you will.
Oh, my gosh. I'm feeling ecstatic. This is like, so my mom just died in April, and her greatest wish in the entire world was that the Cubs would win the World Series. She said, the Cubs are going to win the World Series. And they did.
Ah! It took 108 years. The Cubs have won.
Those are some of the fans watching the game last night in Champaign at the Esquire Lounge. Thanks to producer Christine Herman from that. We want to hear from you fans this hour, wherever you are in the state. This is your chance to share your euphoria with everyone else. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show, 21ST Show. We've been following the Cubs' historic World Series run with WBEZ Cheryl Reistout. She just got back from Cleveland, where the Cubs pulled out a very dramatic Game 7 win last night. Cheryl, it had to be the most dramatic Game 7 of World Series we've seen in modern history, didn't it, for the Cubs to win?
Absolutely. When you think they had it, you know, in grasp, then it all of a sudden gets shaky, and then it gets tied, and then they come back and win it, and then there's a rain delay for 17 minutes, and that rain delay was very big. Because during that rain delay, because the game got tied up just before that, the players held a meeting led by Jason Hayward and David Ross to calm the team down, to get them back focused, and they went out and they had a great inning.
And when you talk about that, when we talk about this team, Cheryl, I do want to talk about the team in a minute and the players and how they're reacting to anything. But I have to ask you first. Mm-hmm. As a lifelong fan, as a sports journalist covering decades of Chicago sports, for you, what was last night like?
Last night was the last jewel for me because I had covered the Super Bowl with the Bears in the 1986 Super Bowl. I covered the White Sox in 2005. I covered all six Bulls championships and all three Blackhawks championships. This was the crown jewel to finally have in my repertoire of coverage.
And you, I mean, when you think about Cubs fans waiting for this for 108 years, what was it like for all those Cubs fans in Cleveland last night?
It was very loud, Nyla. I mean, it was almost, I would say, 60-40 Cleveland fans, but they had 40% for the Cubs fans, was really loud. You could hear, you know, the chanting, and the and when the Indians were down, the Cubs fans became louder and louder, and it was really, it was unbelievable, because I've never heard that at a playoff game on the road, to hear that.
And you flew home to Chicago around 6 this morning. What was it like when you, what was O'Hare like this morning when you got back to the airport?
It's funny, you know, Nyla, I think everybody is wearing some sort of hat or shirt or something, and just seeing the signs, you know, the W signs flying everywhere, and just the joy. Most of the people that were on the flight were from Chicago, and you had a very gracious Cleveland Indians flight attendant being very kind, and it was just very jubilant. One thing about championships, Nyla, is that it doesn't just last one day. It lasts for days and weeks and months all the way to next, you know, when spring training. So it gives you a really good feeling throughout the winter.
Let's talk about this game, Cheryl, because before we get into the specifics of how crazy this game was, let's just talk about the baseball. Was this, do you think, one of the best baseball games, certainly one of the best World Series games we've ever seen?
Play-wise, maybe not, but drama-wise, absolutely, because this was a game where you just didn't know, because you had one of the best pitchers for the Cleveland Indians, Corey Kluber, who was masterful in previous games. He could not get over the hump, and the Cubs were able to attack him. So that happened. You had a dramatic home run right off the bat for the leadoff hitter. So these little instances throughout this game made this a really dramatic ending.
Well, and this was such an emotional time for the players as well. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about this in particular. I loved how Chris Bryant was smiling as he fielded the final out, but I loved how earlier in the game, I think it was maybe the second or third inning, Fox had wired the players, and Anthony Rizzo was on the bench holding on to David Ross. Like, he just couldn't stop. Like, he was hanging on to his arm like a little brother, and he just kept saying, you know, that great line, he was like, "I'm an emotional wreck, man. I'm a glass case of emotion." And I think one of the great storylines of this team all year have been David Ross. And David Ross was just like, he was such a big brother to him, saying, "Man, it's just going to get worse. Wait till we get to the seventh inning. You're just, I know this is really tough, but we're not even close to the end yet." And yeah, go ahead, Cheryl.
Well, the realization for Anthony is that this man, David Ross, went through it with Boston. He knew what was going to happen, and he was able to help him through this. And Anthony has grown so much under David Ross's tutelage. He doesn't think of him as a brother. He thinks of him as a grandfather. And on Father's Day, he gives him a Father's Day card with a grandpa.
Because he's 39, all of 39, right? Well, and I wanted to play a little bit of David Ross. You know, he announced before the year started this was going to be his last season before retiring. He went on to have the season of his career. We have a clip of him after the win last night. Let's take a listen to him.
David, this was your final game. It was an epic game. What was it like to play in this?
A lot of ups and downs. I'm totally exhausted. What a group of winners. What a group of resilient winners. These guys have never quit. They've answered every challenge all year long. When you want to just crumble when that ball goes over the fence, these guys fight back.
And what do you think it means? Like, what role do you think David Ross played as a leadership role as well as a mentoring role? You started to talk about that with Anthony Rizzo. What about all the other guys on the team?
He's done it with everyone. He's helped like the catcher, Wilson Contreras, who was a very young catcher. He mentors just to the T. He mentors well. He listens to them. He talks to them. He talks to everybody. Nyla, when you go into that locker room, he greets us. Who does that? Nobody does that.
Does he say, "Hey, Cheryl"? He talks to all the journalists as well.
He says, "Hi, media. How you doing today?" I mean, he's big. But he's very personal, and I think in this day and age, especially in sports, you need that type of mentoring, because you know the emotions could get so raw and get so out of whack. You need somebody that knows how to put it in perspective, give them the pat on the back or some kind words, and that's what David Ross does. He will be missed, but I have a feeling somehow he's either going to end up a manager or a coach somewhere. But I wouldn't doubt if Theo Epstein would like to ask him to find a role with the Cubs.
Let's talk about the locker room last night, Cheryl. I mean, what was the atmosphere inside there? I mean, we saw all the champagne. I think it might have been my favorite interview, the drunk Bill Murray interviewing a drunk Theo Epstein. Like, that was great. It's a kind of random exchange. But what was it like in there?
It was cramped. I got Dexter Fowler, he opened up a bottle of champagne and the cork hit me in the stomach.
Oh, no.
I was interviewing Theo Epstein and he was drinking so much. I'm like, I don't know how good this interview is going to go. But it was controlled chaos. And it was, there was so many people in this cramped space. And it was just, the euphoria was huge. It was massive. And it was like not that weight, but just absolute joy. That's what it was in that room, and the people that put it together, and the players that you know were able to do the job and win, and do what Joe Maddon said, embrace the target. They did that under duress. They did something that doesn't happen often: come down from a 3-1 deficit to win and win it on the road. And the fact that they had to do it in this clubhouse, because it's a small clubhouse. When you go to when you're a visiting team, your room is not very big.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, so it kind of made it intimate rather than being so big, you know, when you go on the field. It was really, there was a real family feeling in there.
Cheryl, how does it compare to what the locker room was like after the Bulls won their first national championship, or the Sox? Can you compare them?
They're so different, Nyla, and it's such a different feeling. When the Bulls won in 91 and I was there, the interesting part about that, there wasn't as many media people that were covering at the time. And again, it was on the road. And I always liked the road, being on the road for wins, and I'm being selfish about that because the players, they know me and they'll give me really good interviews. And it's you built the relationship, and this is when there's a payoff. And so you have that, and because I was right by Michael when he was crying and his dad was there, so you have those such emotional times. And then with the White Sox, it was another emotional time because it had been 88 years since they had it, and they were also on the road. And one of the players, Willie Harris, he was allergic to champagne, so they actually left the clubhouse and went on the field on purpose because it was the only way that he could
wouldn't get sprayed.
Yeah, yeah.
Cheryl, when you think about that, when you think about interviews, for you, what was the interview you did yesterday evening that kind of stood out for you when you were talking to all the players? What sticks out in your mind?
Addison Russell.
Addison Russell, so let's set up for everybody, 22 years old.
22 years old, and, you know, the other night he had the grand slam, he had 6 RBI. But it isn't just what he did on at the plate. I got to know him last year and get to know him this year. We sat down for a nice long interview, and I just heard his maturity come out.
Well, we should say he's a dad. He's 22, right?
His wife is 22. They're very young. But what he talked about the meeting that the team had, and he said, "I was crying. I wanted to win so bad. Several of us were crying," and he admitted to that. And he was just talking about the other fact that he was bringing up that I really loved hearing was that this is not the first time. We have more growth to have, more wins to have, more championships. So he's already realizing that this team, if they stay together, which they will, they could collectively go on and win more championships.
And what about players like Dexter Fowler? Because he was going to go to Baltimore, gave up millions, right, Cheryl?
Yes.
I wouldn't sure reminder of the one who popped the champagne bottle into your stomach, right?
Yeah, right
into my he
stomach.
Came back to the Cubs, but he came back. He turned down a lot of money to come back and to play for a year, for a one-year contract.
Right.
What do you think? What is it? What I wonder for him, what yesterday evening was like, but then also what that says about the team and the organization.
Yeah, you know, he knew after last year how good it was, and you could tell that was going in the trajectory it went in this year. And sometimes I've seen other players do that. They'll leave the money because they want to win. And if you do that and you're successful, at the end of this year, now he's a free agent. And so he could either stay with the Cubs. They're going to try and make him an offer, but there's other teams out there. And he was very important to this team to make them go. And he was very important as far as being a leadoff man and what he did in the field. So it was an important moment for him to do that. And the way he did it, the way the team did not know he was going to be there as far as the players went, and he walks on to spring training. And those are those little jolts of, you know, like adrenaline that a team gets collectively when somebody does something like that. And that is what I think helped them start, get off to a good start.
Cheryl, as I think about this, I wonder, as we're thinking about this being not just one of the most historic moments in not just Chicago history, but sports history, where you would put last night in sort of American sports history?
It's got to be right at the top, because 108 years is a long time not to win. And, you know, you're talking about a franchise that's been around that long, you know, in basketball and even, you know, football. And those teams haven't been around as long as the Cubs, and the Cubs hadn't won in all those years. And the way they won it and the way this team was built, this is going to be a team that's going to be a model for other organizations in the future to do it the way they did it. I don't know if they could copy it completely, but they actually have the blueprint on how to build a team to go forward and be successful. And that's why it's one of the best sports stories that we'll ever see.
That's WBEZ's Cheryl Reistout. We'll continue our coverage of the Cubs' historic World Series win. Let's take a listen. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about the Chicago Cubs' historic World Series win last night.
There are many Cub fans in attendance wondering if they will see history tonight.
If they lose, I will be sad, but I will try to concentrate on the fact that they ran the pennant.
If the Cubs win the World Series, it would be the happiest night of my life.
It's going great. I was really scared coming into it that they were going to have some trouble, but they got out to an early lead, and so it's just been a really energetic night.
I'm feeling pretty great. I really got nervous. I started to think the Cubs were going to choke, but then...
This is game 7, extra innings.
How are you feeling?
I'm feeling amazing right now because I have faith in Chicago Cubs right now.
When I was in grade school, on the north side in grade school, I would cut opening day in grade school to go to games.
I cried.
Oh my God.
I was crying. The tears were running down my cheeks. I thought we were going to lose. Then I thought we were going to win. Then I thought we were going to lose. And I'm like, we're going to win. Now we are winners, and the goat needs to be fried and gotten rid of.
Those are voices of Cubs fans all across Illinois. That was from Chicago and Wrigleyville and Champaign at the Esquire Lounge and at Inman Place, an assisted living facility where they canceled their usual Wednesday night movie to watch the Cubs game. Thanks to 21st team Howla Delahi, Christine Herman, and WBEZ's Patrick Smith for that audio. If you have thoughts on the game or season or want to share a story of what it was like to see your lovable losers become World Series champs, you can tweet us at 21st Show or give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. We're joined on the phone now by Jesse Rogers, who's the Cubs beat reporter for ESPN, been following the team all season. Hey, Jesse, thanks for joining us on the 21st.
My pleasure. What's going on? How are you feeling today?
Oh, man, I think everybody's feeling this all across Illinois. We're exhausted but exhilarated, I think is probably the word everyone's using. So let me ask you, the expectations for this team were to win the World Series from the get-go, which is obviously something that's easier said than done. How do you think they manage that huge burden of 108 years all on their backs this season?
Yeah, you know, I learned something watching this team. The better you are, the more talented you are, the more confident you are, you can put all those things behind you. And Joe Maddon was the perfect manager for for this moment. He thought about it last winter. He thought about how should we approach this season as favorites? Because think about the sort of the dichotomy here. You are favorites to win something you haven't won in, as you mentioned, 108 years. So it's a very strange, awkward feeling. But he decided to forget the history. None of those players have been there 108 years. We know, you know, if you're a fan, you haven't been here 108 years. So it's really about the here and now was the point, and embracing the moment. And that's what they did all season long. They really stayed in that moment. And that was key. In the worst of times in the playoffs, they made sure they didn't get too emotional, which was the same way they acted during the regular season, even when things were going well. It's really a lesson to fall back on. Just keep an even keel. Stay with your process as long as you believe in it. And they were able to do it. So, you know, I was very impressed with this postseason. Every time they had a moment that could have gotten them down, they rebounded. And that was the difference, in my opinion, between this Cubs team and many others. Others let bad moments magnify. This team did not.
You know, as a sports journalist, I'm sure you're used to all the cliches. I wanted to play just a little quick clip of Joe Maddon after the World Series game.
And after the game, even on the mound there, as we're taking the photographs, the guys are chanting, we don't quit, we don't quit. We don't quit. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. I mean, you hear that all the time, and I know everybody says it, but you have to actually live it. And I have to tell you, I mean, I've seen it so many times from this group, and that's a big part of our philosophy. And I like to keep things simple, and that's simple, and I don't want to get complicated. We've just played 27 outs.
Do you think this is one of those rare times where the cliche is true? How much of this has to do with Joe Maddon and his leadership style?
I think it's easier to be true when you're so talented and deep, because he can't be the first manager to say we play 27 outs, right, and we don't quit. I'm not saying there is something unique about them in this leadership group that doesn't allow them to get down, like I said, like especially with the young players. For them to succeed the way they did this year, that's quite impressive. So I think there's something to it, but I think it has to do with being talented, deep, and competent in your abilities as well. You can be a bad team, play for 27 outs, and still not win, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You have to have something behind that, and they have a ton of talent, confidence, and again, youth that is playing well beyond their years, because I think it's been instilled in them by their manager and the veterans on this team.
Jesse, one quick question for you, because I know you've got to run. What about the fans? What role do you think fans played in all of this, especially after such a historic drought?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I could go on for an hour about this, because I think there was a psychology in this.
I was going to say, you can go on as long as you want, but I know you've got a busy day.
Yeah, I gotta go. I think there's a psychology in this series that played against the home team. I really do. Think about how the Indians played at Wrigley Field and how the Cubs played in Cleveland.
Oh, it's interesting, right.
I think they played their best baseball on the road, both teams, because both franchises, both fan bases had this weight on their shoulders. And I really think the best thing to happen to the Cubs once they got down 3-2 was to play the next two games on the road, put their backs against the wall, get away from everything at Wrigley Field, and play them on the road. That is not a cliche. I truly believe that. I said it before game six, that I think this will be better for them. So the fan bases play a great role, but it's a weight. There was a weight, and I don't mean W-A-I-T. There was a weight on their shoulders, and I think they needed to get out of Chicago and get back to their best baseball on the road here, and that's what happened. That's just my opinion. I don't know if it's true.
That's Jesse Rogers. He's ESPN Cubs beat reporter. Hey, Jesse, thanks for taking the time to be with us this morning.
Sure, anytime. Take care.
So what Jesse is saying, weight, W-E-I-G-H-T, but what about the weight for all of the fans? And what a roller coaster it was for Cubs fans, whether they were in Chicago or across Illinois. And I want to talk to two fans that we have been checking in throughout the season with to talk about one final conversation with them. We can celebrate with them one last time. Amar Madhani is a USA Today Chicago correspondent. Jan Bowling is a friend of mine who took me to my first Cubs game in Chicago several years ago. She's been going to Cubs games for 62 years, awaiting this day. Jan, Amar, go Cubs. How are you guys feeling this morning?
Feeling fine.
Amar?
The butterflies are finally gone from my stomach. And I think Rajay Davis just like kicked the entire city in the stomach there with that home run in the eighth inning. But I finally have overcome that, and the exhilaration of winning was the best medicine I could have.
It really is. Jan, let me ask you about this. You've been going to games for 62 years. You started going to games with the famed Bleacher Bums. You moved to season tickets kind of off out of kind of more closer to the infield. There's so much history. What was last night like for you?
Well, it was unbelievable, as everyone has said, and I've texted friends and family, and it's fantastic, but it's frazzling. I mean, people were saying, oh, I think I'm going to throw up. I think I'm
going
to
have a heart attack. Oh, I felt that way. I think I did feel physically sick at one point.
The whole game. So there was even, you know, as your friend with whom you are now speaking to is saying, you just have a physical reaction to the game and a physical reaction to the win. It's just unusual. You know, just weird.
And at that moment, when they had that last out after the rain delay, what did you think, Jan?
I couldn't believe they had done it. I really couldn't. I was so confused. I usually can keep track of the batting order. I know who's pitching. You know, I'm well aware of what's happening in the game. It was just one big blur. And it's like, oh, my God, there's the score, and we won. You know, players are on the field, but you needed all these physical signs to think, oh, this really, really, really happened. Unbelievable.
Amar, what about you? What did you do right after that final out?
Well, I was working last night.
You were also working.
So
where were you?
Part for me. I was in Wrigleyville, so the first game was at what dubs itself as America's Creepiest Bar, L&L Tavern, which is about 5-6 blocks south of Wrigley Field. And you're just watching people's emotions and having these emotions, often sort of having to do my job and not let my emotions show was a little bit of a task, but it was numbing, just, and it was incredible just to be around all these people who cared so much about what was happening and were living on every pitch and were on their seat's edge and standing and chanting as if they were in Cleveland. It was one of the most remarkable moments of growing up and living in Chicago that I can ever recall.
Jan, I know that you have a ritual in your house when you're not at Wrigley where you have to watch in a different room for your husband. Did you guys do that yesterday evening? Were you
Actually,
on a different...
We went to our son's and daughter-in-law's home watched until the rain delay, and they don't live far. So we came home, and then the ritual was on, and it worked.
It worked. So he's downstairs and you're upstairs. Is that what happens?
Correct.
And so you were actually by yourself with that final out.
I was, and it worked for me. I mean, it was like this is a moment of glory for my team that I can enjoy. I don't have to worry about anybody else in the room. Boy, what a personal moment for me. Sounds selfish, but it was great.
But I mean, I think that Jan, if you can, I mean, we think back your entire life. You used to teach school, used to teach preschool right near
and first grade,
right near the park. So you would spend afternoons going to Wrigley games. How many years ago was that?
Oh, let's see. That was probably in the 70s.
In the 70s. Okay. And then you, now that you've been retired, you get a chance to go to even more games, I imagine.
Yeah.
What was it like for you, though? Did you feel like, it was so interesting hearing Jesse, the ESPN beat reporter, saying that he felt like, in a way, it was easier, there was less pressure for the Cubs to be doing this outside of Chicago. As a fan, how do you feel about that?
Well, when he was saying this, I was thinking, I disagree with this man. I think it had to do with the designated hitter. And so I think there was a logical reason for it. I think that when the Cubs came out, and probably the second or third thank you out of their mouths is, let's thank the fans, that those fans dragged them and stood by them through a lot. And I think that, you know, even though they only won one game at home, the fan base at that last game that propelled them into the series was wild. I mean, fans were cheering and standing the whole time, and I think it really does affect the team in a positive way to have the fans behind you. These are fans that don't give up. You know, could you ask for anything more?
Yeah, go ahead, Armour.
It discounts just what a fantastic team Cleveland was. I'm so happy that my team was on the winning side of this. This was a great series against another incredibly talented young team. And they were just so evenly matched. And, you know, I agree with Jan. You know, I think the being away from home had very little to do with it. And, you know, at the other end, you know, David Ross and some of the other clubs have talked about how great it was to have such a sea of blue in Cleveland for the final two games.
I want to ask, Armour, you know, we started this season talking to you about the misery of Cubs fans. And do you think the exhilaration of last night, do you think that wipes all of that out?
Oh, yeah. You know, this is an incredible moment. This is, I think, the greatest moment in Chicago sports history. You know, living through the 90s and the Bull Michael Jordan era, for me, you know, Michael Jordan, you know, the shot will always be memorable, but the sober single or the double in the 10th with for the go-ahead run will be the most remarkable moment in Chicago sports history. And he didn't have to push off like Jordan did.
Jan, most memorable moment last night in Chicago sports history?
That last out. It was, you know, your heart is just beating and beating and beating, and you know, it took so long to get there, and we're in extra innings. And then, you know, just to think, oh, my God, the Cubs just won the World Series. And I saw it. It doesn't matter if I saw it on TV or in the park. I watched some history here, and it was my Cubbies making that history.
That's Jan Bullig. I want to thank Jan and Armour Madhani, who's a USA Today Chicago correspondent, both of our Cubs fans who've been with us all season. Thanks for being with me, guys.
Oh, well, we're happy. Happy day.
One last time, let's hear Go Cubs Go and the voices of fans singing along with all their hearts from across the state after last night's historic win.
Baseball season's underway. Well, you better get ready for a brand new
I'm Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When the Chicago Tribune endorsed Democrat Tammy Duckworth over incumbent Republican Senator Mark Kirk for the U.S. Senate race last month, it raised a lot of questions for some people, not because of the politics, but because the endorsement did make an issue of Senator Kirk's 2012 stroke. The editorial board included this sentence in what they wrote. While a stroke by no means disqualifies anyone from public office, we cannot tiptoe around the issue of Kirk's recovery and readiness. That line caught the attention of Richard Harris. He's a freelance writer who himself suffered a stroke in 2000. In a recent piece he wrote for the website nextavenue.org, he says, quote, I'm sensitized on how to use the word stroke can label someone as, quote, somehow less than a full person. Richard Harris joins us by phone from his home in Maryland. We should point out he's a former Chicagoan and a Northwestern University grad. Hey, Richard, welcome to the 21st and welcome back to Illinois Airwaves, at least virtually.
Thanks, Myla.
Richard, how did you read that endorsement at first? What kind of went through your head?
Well, what happened was I was walking through an art fair in downtown Bethesda here outside Washington several weekends ago, and I bumped into Lynn Sweet, the Washington bureau chief of the Sun-Times, and I asked her about the Duckworth-Kirk Senate race. I was just kind of curious because I heard that that's one of the pivotal races that could, in fact, turn the Senate Democratic. And she said, have I seen the Tribune editorial endorsing Duckworth that had just come out? And I said, no. So I went home and read it, and I was kind of taken aback. And, you know, I don't have a dog in the fight. I don't care who wins or loses. But as a stroke survivor, and mine put me out of commission for about 3 months, 16 years ago, I made a full recovery, and I'm very thankful. So my, as I said in my piece, my story pales compared to Senator Kirk. But I was really troubled by the way the Tribune framed the Duckworth endorsement through his stroke, and I thought that was wrong. As you just quoted, you know, the Tribune said, while a stroke by no means qualifies anyone from public office, we can't tiptoe around the issue of Kirk's recovery and readiness. And I felt that they were kind of defining him by his stroke. It reminded me of that line really from Arkansas Senator Dale Bumpers from the late 90s when he says, when you hear somebody say this is not about sex, it's about sex. And I felt in this particular case, the Tribune tried to say our endorsement is not about Kirk's stroke, but it clearly was.
And I'm relating this back to your personal experience. You said you back in 2000 had a stroke, you made a full recovery. But how did that change the way people viewed you or your abilities?
Well, it's very hard to intuit, you know, from somebody's reaction. But, you know, a very small point is that here I am 16 years later, and some people who have not seen me for quite a while, you know, will ask me about my health, even though I feel my stroke and the effects from it are well into the rearview mirror. And I just, it's not anything mean-spirited or anything that I particularly care about, because I think people who care about somebody else's health is a good thing. But I do think it kind of signals that stroke is a very powerful word, and the danger is if you use it incorrectly, and I felt that the Tribune in this particular case did, it's a little bit like my former boss, Ted Koppel, used to say, the emphasis is on a different syllable. I don't think that stroke should not have been mentioned. It is the elephant in the room with Kirk. It should be mentioned. But it's a question of how. And if you compare the Tribune's endorsement of Duckworth to the Sun-Times endorsement of Duckworth, what you'll find is the Tribune endorsement is very stroke-centric as opposed to performance-centric, whereas the Sun-Times mentions the stroke, but just in passing. And I think that's the way I feel I and other stroke survivors want to be judged, by our performance, our ability to connect with other people, and we're not defined by some event that happened in our life either years ago or months ago.
Richard, as you mentioned, you're a journalist. You worked for Nightline. Very avid public radio listeners, I think, will recognize your voice from newscasts from NPR. You've worked for other media organizations. So I think you do what we do as journalists, right? You read the editorial, but you didn't stop there. You did some reporting. And one of the people you reached out to was a woman in Illinois named Susan Danzig. What was her perspective on the Tribune editorial?
Well, the reason I reached out to Susan, and I did not know her at all, but I noticed a tweet. And she's a diehard Democrat who is a big Duckworth supporter, but she said in her tweet that what the Tribune did was wrong, and I felt she had more credibility to criticize as a diehard Democrat than somebody who was necessarily a Kirk supporter. And I talked to Susan, and she felt the way I did, that you judge somebody by the quality of their performance in office or their likelihood at this point to be the next senator from Illinois who can serve all the people. And the Tribune came down on the side of Duckworth, as did the Sun-Times. But it was the way they did it. It was kind of the circuitous route that I think rubbed me wrong, Susan Danzig, and some other people who I've read. And I noticed that, you know, Kirk wrote his own op-ed piece following this Tribune endorsement, and he called it, you know, being sucker punched by the Tribune. And I get that. And he acknowledged that, in fact, he is not the person he was before the stroke. He can't run as fast or do other things. But I think what he's asking for is to be judged by his performance. And some other, you know, another Tribune columnist, Eric Zorn, I noticed, you know, had looked at the debate between Duckworth and Kirk at the Tribune earlier in October and came to the conclusion that Kirk's answers were very brief, were not necessarily to the point. And I think that's all valid material. The question really becomes, as a journalist who does not have a medical degree, and I don't think many journalists do, how can you necessarily equate the performance of a politician in office with their medical history? I mean, even a prominent neurologist would have a hard time discerning whether a particular comment that Kirk made is attributable to his stroke. So I think it's a very slippery slope and a difficult issue for a newspaper to judge a politician based on their medical history as opposed to their performance.
And you got in touch with the Tribune editorial page editor, John McCormick, and I want to get to the insight he shared with you in a minute. But what did he first, what did he say to you about their decision to include Kirk's stroke in their thinking about the endorsement?
Well, he really assured me that nobody on the editorial board was gunning for Kirk. And he mentioned that, in fact, the Tribune had endorsed Kirk six previous times. And that the editorial page leans Republican, that's no secret. And the quote I remember is him saying that the last thing the Tribune wanted to do, you know, was nominate or endorse Duckworth, because that's just not who they are. They are a moderate Republican editorial page, so Kirk is the obvious person. And then he, out of the blue, said, "I don't want to be coy with you. Your stroke was 3 years before mine, and we walked very similar paths."
Wow!
And it was
so he said, "I've
at that point."
Right.
I know. I was.
What did
was
you?
Just,
what was
just,
your reaction at that point?
Well, I was stunned, only in the sense that I think the lesson that all of us should draw from that is that We can prejudge somebody's motives and intentions, but until we actually talk with them and understand who they are and where they're coming from, maybe we don't have the full picture. And I had to conclude that based on the fact that he did walk in my shoes and he does understand what it means to go through the stroke process and come out the other end whole, I think he may have a better appreciation for whether a stroke should define somebody or not. And I really gave him and the paper more of a pass once I learned that their motivation in writing this editorial the way they did was not necessarily about saying he should not be a senator because he had a stroke.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it sort of came out that way, I think their intention was to say there are medical issues that we're concerned about.
So, Richard, that conversation then, I guess it did change your mind about how the editorial board framed their endorsement.
It did. It did. You know, I still would not have written the editorial the way they did, but it made me less likely to believe that they had ill intent of defining Kirk simply by his stroke, which I think is a danger for any of us. I mean, I had a colleague at Nightline, a former executive producer, who unfortunately passed away because of cancer. And in the year or so leading up to his death, he wrote a daily blog for NPR about what it's like to be a cancer patient. And one of the things I quoted from in my piece is when Leroy Sievers, you know, talked about that cancer is not something that should define me. I was more than that. And I think that's true for any of us who have been through any kind of medical issue, that label can be very hurtful if it's used incorrectly.
And that said, Richard, my last question to you is just what do you hope comes out of this? Now that you've written this piece, I don't know what kind of feedback you've gotten. What's your hope with how to just maybe as it sounds like you're saying, people just sort of think about things a little bit differently, approach things a little bit differently?
I think, you know, part of it is simply giving people a little bit of the benefit of the doubt when you see something and you haven't had a chance to really talk to the person who has written the editorial. You know, give people a chance. And the other part of it is when you hear that somebody has had a stroke. I mean, this is a pretty unique Senate race where you've had two people who've come from incredibly challenging physical issues. Tammy Duckworth lost both of her legs as in the Iraq War, and of course Kirk had a serious stroke. Both have clawed their way back, and I think both of them deserve the appreciation and respect for doing so. But I hope one of the things that comes out of this for everybody is that when you hear that somebody has had a physical or mental or emotional issue in their life, that you wouldn't define these people by that event.
Richard Harris is a freelance writer. His article that we've been talking about is headlined, "Should a Stroke Disqualify a Candidate?" We'll put a link to it out. We'll tweet it from our account, 21ST Show. Richard, thanks for taking the time to talk with us about this. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Nyla.
Speaking of politics, on Monday, we are going to be doing an entire fact-checking hour for you the day before the election. The Washington Post fact-checker will be along with some folks from PolitiFact Illinois. If you have specific questions, if there are facts that you want checked, email us, talk@21stshow.org, tweet to our account, 21stshow, or send us a Facebook message. To wrap up today's show, I want to say special thanks to the 21st team and other journalists who stayed up very late last night, or this morning, really, to help put together this Cubs show. For those of you who don't know, among famous Cubs fans like Bill Murray is Pearl Jam frontman Eddie Vedder. The Evanston-born rock star is such a huge Cubs fan, Mr. Cubs, Ernie Banks, asked Eddie Vedder to write a song about the team after Vedder went to fantasy camp. He wrote this in 2007. We thought we'd go out on the show today and end with it, because today, someday, is finally today.
Don't let anyone say that it's just a game, for I've seen other teams and it's never the same. When you're born in Chicago, you're blessed and you're a heel. The first time you walk into Wrigley Field, our heroes wear pinstripes, heroes in blue. Give us the chance to feel like heroes too. Forever we'll win. And if we should lose, we know someday we'll go all the way.
I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. One last time, go Cubs.
We are one with the Cubs. With the Cubs, we're in love. Yeah, hold our head high as the underdogs. We are not fair weather, but fair weather fans. Like brothers in arms in the streets and the stands. There's magic in the ivy in the old scoreboard. The same when I stared at as a kid keeping score. In a world full of greed.